Hi, everyone. This is Both Sides of the Aisle. I am Natalie Gochner, and I represent the political center. On the political left, Shireen Gourbani.
Hello, and hey, listeners. Glad you're with us.
And on the political right, John Dougal.
Hey, good to be with you.
I never know who to start with. I just kind of go back and forth.
You go back and forth.
Yeah. I just don't want to show favoritism.
There's that coin toss at the start of the show. No.
Bad news, you two. We have
BYU lost.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
And Utah State lost.
We have global events dominating the picture, and I just think that's bad news because we really want to talk local here.
Yeah.
But you can't really do local when the global is so dominant. Fair?
Fair.
I guess. Yeah. I mean, I can see your argument.
Yeah. We're 24 days in. Roughly, we're recording this on Monday of this week into the Iran war. Yeah. There seems to be a lot of escalation going on. It feels like a really troubling outlook. We have a president that has basically issued a pause saying, hey, let's stop. I don't know how many days did he say. 5 days.
Yeah.
I won't bomb your power infrastructure if you get to the table with me and figure out how we're going to get the strait open and move forward with some sort of diplomatic solution. Both of you comment on that.
So by the time listeners are hearing this, we'll be right at the end of this 5-day period. So it will be very interesting to see what has transpired over the week, since our recording to that moment. But what I will say is it sounds like there's been some pretty significant, I would just say maybe trustworthy reporting that suggests there are back channel conversations happening. The kinds of conversations that Trump is suggesting are happening are a little bit more difficult to verify at this point. So exactly what it means to come to the table and what kinds of negotiations need to happen for any resolution here is kind of classic Trump to me. If we keep just moving the target and we keep it incredibly vague, then we can call kind of whatever happens a success. I mean, to the point where J.D. Vance is out there saying, hey, yeah, your gas prices have gone up basically a dollar a gallon at the tank. But just imagine if you were in Europe, it would be so much worse. Like, they just keep spinning out whatever.
I heard it was Joe Biden's fault.
Oh, you can ask Spencer Cox about Joe Biden's fault related to our ICE detention facility. But there is just an unbelievable amount of just shifting that we have to accept with this president. So it wouldn't surprise me if in 5 days we have some sort of resolution. But to what?
So, I mean, I can be hopeful that they're talking and dialoguing, but Iran over the decades has stalled and stalled and stalled in negotiations. Part of the excuse for Trump bombing them just a few weeks ago, 3-4 weeks ago, was because they were not serious at the negotiating table. And so therefore, I'm skeptical of what's really going to come out of it. Mm-hmm. And I'm fearful of what kind of escalation is going to happen as a result of we've got to figure out some resolution. The 47 years is unacceptable. Yeah. We've got to figure out some kind of resolution to this, not just for the U.S., for Middle East peace.
Yeah. So Iran is a menace globally, but it's a complex menace. And I ask the question, can you, with big bombs, quiet a networked menace? Mm. this idea that
highly decentralized,
how do they ever stop anything? With
and just because you do a deal with one, will the others buy into it?
I read a column, I think it was in The Economist magazine, but they talked about the columnists, instead of calling this epic fury, he called it blind fury.
Yeah. Yeah, I think if we're going to talk about the menace of Iran in the Middle East, we have to acknowledge that we have become a global menace as well. What happened in Venezuela without any international support, what is happening now in Iran, the threats that we're hearing about Cuba and beyond, the United States is off the rails when it comes to any sort of guiding core principles around democracy or global engagement. So I feel like it's just a tinderbox. Like, it is a perfect storm.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and I look, and I'm one that's a fan of Ronald Reagan. I would describe as Ronald Reagan called his shots. I mean, you knew what his agenda was. You knew where he was driving. You knew what he was pursuing. There was no question about his agenda.
Mm-hmm. My husband doesn't like this war, but we were watching Sunday programs and he kind of deals with me and watches what I want to watch. And they had the Israeli ambassador for the United States on, and my husband was really impressed with him, which surprised me. But it was because he was making sense and he was consistent. And my husband maybe didn't agree with him, but it didn't seem like, he was pounding his chest or anything like that. In contrast, when my husband hears members of our cabinet speak or the president. He's just so offended by the sort of lack of decorum.
Decorum, yeah.
Leadership. I just thought that was interesting because a lot of times people point Israel as the bad guy. My husband was really impressed with the Israeli ambassador.
So I'm going to describe your husband probably buys into when the law's on your side, pound the law. When the facts are on your side, pound the facts. When neither are on your side, pound the table. Mm-hmm. And he's probably seen that from various folks.
Yeah, perhaps.
I wanted to add, we had a brief conversation about the Strait of Hormuz, which continues to be not fully open, certainly putting constraints on oil prices, right, internationally. But the thing that you had mentioned, John, last week was the impact on fertilizer, which is something that more directly impacts Utahns. And I noticed—
And you don't feel it immediately, us food prices, but farmers feel it immediately.
Feel it immediately. So there was a story in the Salt Lake Tribune that really looks at, you know, what the impact of the increasing costs. Well, we know that farming, especially for small farmers, has been a bit of a losing gamble in America in recent— Recently, it's not easy to run a small farm.
The sad joke is you want to know how to make a small fortune in farming? Start with a large fortune.
Right. Start with a large fortune. That's exactly right.
It's just a difficult—
That's pretty good, John.
I didn't make it up, but it's a difficult industry. Uh-huh.
So this is $2.3 billion in our state's economy. And this is from a report from the Gardner Institute from 2022. Mostly that's coming from livestock and poultry, which have a heavy reliance on fertilizer in their programs, right? And the cost increase that Utah farmers are experiencing is between 50 and 70% for fertilizer. That was over the course of this last year. So that's around tariffs. That's around the global trade disruption that we've already seen. So to imagine what comes next for those farmers is really concerning. And they also noted the spike of 40% in diesel just this week alone. Mm. So for folks who are already living on the edge, which unfortunately is a lot of farmers in our state, this is terrifying.
Yeah. Well, and then we have the administration looking for a $200 billion appropriation to help pay for this war. That takes 60 votes, according to the Senate rules.
Yeah. If you got the filibuster in place.
So. You have Secretary Hegseth saying, hey, it takes money to kill bad guys. This is tricky stuff. I mean, I think it's going to be hard for them to get that.
Yeah, $200 billion is a lot of money. And there's a lot of Americans going, yeah, but that could have been used for other purposes.
Yeah.
And there's various folks on the right that are going, wait, that this was the peace president. I thought we were going to avoid war. I thought we were going to get out of endless wars in the Middle East. And yet they feel like we got sucked right back in.
And some of the biggest proponents of that, what has now come to, I thought it was a lie in the beginning, but falsehood that we're experiencing in real time, were people like Pete Hegseth and people like J.D. Vance, who said we simply had to vote for Donald Trump so that we wouldn't be in war with Iran. In fact, I believe Tulsi Gabbard sold shirts that said no war with Iran, and now she's part of this as well. So to me, like, I know that pointing out the hypocrisy is pointless, but it just feels really dire.
Well, this feeds into Tucker Carlson's continued rise. He has called this catastrophic, this war.
Yeah.
He also basically says that the president has lost his way. So,
and that he's been sucked in by Israel.
Well, the question I have here is, do we think that this has meaningful impact? Is this the breaking point for the MAGA, which I think we should just be calling Trump fever? Are we at a breaking point? What do you think when you listen to folks on your side of the aisle?
I'm seeing a lot of conservatives that right now are saying, I was sold a bill of goods. I voted for peace. I voted for putting America first. I didn't vote for nation building. And so they are rethinking, and they feel like they were lied to.
Yeah.
They feel like they're getting the opposite of what they voted for. And they want more of Trump first edition, you know, his first term, and not what's going on in the second term.
And I think the window is just kind of closing. There's still a window for a diplomatic solution and a president that's done hard things and investing in something that no one was willing to do and take care of this menace. But the American public's patience will thin.
Thin.
I come from the perspective when you think you're so egotistical that you think you're the smartest person in the room, you're not.
I have some polling data that essentially says what it's from 48% to 56% of Americans oppose what's going on. So that's pretty heavy.
And if my understanding is this is the worst early polling. So normally there's pretty high, like people in this country, unfortunately, kind of like it when we go to war. Uh-huh. And we're usually told a reason why we're going to war. And people can typically understand it because it's consistent and we get behind it. Not all of us, but you know what I'm saying. This is not that.
Yeah. Those polling numbers jump to as high as 75% against it if ground troops are involved.
Yes.
Yeah. Now, if in a month or two we find peace, there's settlement, it's lasting, then he'll be viewed as a genius.
Let's end this section with just another minute plus on the DHS funding, Homeland Security funding.
Yeah.
Are you guys traveling at all? I mean, I did a lot of traveling in the past.
I keep driving back and forth between Salt Lake City and Utah County.
Well, I'm just glad. I had a heavy airport traffic, you know, the last 6 weeks, but I'm back and I'm sure glad because those lines look awful.
They look awful. I do think that Salt Lake City International Airport continues to be okay, not as impacted as some of the other locations. But the images coming out, well, and there was a terrible crash at LaGuardia. So, New York City is obviously severely disrupted, but some of the lines in Atlanta and other major airports are stunning.
The majority leader has this simple proposal, just pass everything without ICE support and get everything back up online. Seems common sense. They use that word a lot.
Yeah, they use that word a lot in Congress, but they don't seem to have it. So, I'm no fan of the TSA, but it's like literally we're 5 weeks into this, and I know some want to say it's the Democrats, others say there's Republicans. I just point out it's Congress. It takes two to tango. You know,
get it opened.
Figure out how to deal with this. Yeah. And if we don't want TSA, well, then great. Let's get rid of TSA and let's get something better if we don't want to fund that. This is just ridiculous where we're at.
Let's take a short break. Natalie Gochner with Shireen Gorbani and John Dougal. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle on UPR. We'd love to hear from our listeners like you. If you'd like to send us a comment, email BSOTAPodcast@gmail.com. Once again, that's BSOTAPodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.
Shireen Gorbani on the left.
John Dougal on the right.
And Natalie Gochner in the political center. This is Both Sides of the Aisle. We want to talk about this move by the Trump administration to demand the private voter data in the state of Utah and our Lieutenant Governor Deidre Henderson basically asking the federal court to dismiss it. She wants to keep voter rolls local.
Yeah. I've actually been incredibly proud of her. She's been putting out, I would say, she's been putting forth a good effort to battle disinformation around how people think about our voting rolls and whether or not voting is secure in our state. And she's been making, or her office has been making, incredibly clear and I would say distinct, like special to Utah, describing what happens and what really is truth and what is not. And there's a real concern here that I think a lot of people on my side of the aisle, and I think maybe just reasonable election people are concerned that what Trump is trying to do here is ultimately provide a glide path to disrupting the next election.
Yeah. John, do you see this as violating our privacy laws as a state to share these voter rolls with the federal government?
I don't know about that, but I'm going to see it as very concerning and troubling. Mm-hmm. I'm always cautious about what role the federal government should play, how much data they should have. I look at this and one of the strengths of our election process is it's highly decentralized. Mm-hmm. It's largely run at the county level and even down in the precincts. And so the more you centralize it, the more it makes it easier to go hack and attack elections. And so while the Constitution allows Congress to deal some with time, place, and manner of federal elections, it doesn't give that authority to the president. And so I look at this and I'm very concerned to say, okay, I do not want my voter data turned over to the federal government. They've already lost enough of my data over the years with various federal data breaches. It causes me a lot of concern, and I don't see a compelling reason or authority for the president to weigh in on this.
Yeah.
Congress, has constitutional authority if they choose to.
I've been open at times that our lieutenant governor is an elected official that I really admire. I see her as often in a lonely place where she's trying to do what's right with the assignments, you know, the stewardship that she has, and tries to do it in an apolitical way, as a state election office should, but often gets put in these precarious kind of situations. And I it's not fun to be sued by the Justice Department.
No. Over the years, more and more power and responsibility has been placed on our lieutenant governor in the state of Utah.
Shireen, caucus night happened.
Yes.
Are you a delegate?
I am not a delegate.
I guess 5,000 more people across the state at least registered for these meetings, and it was a 34.4% increase.
Yeah, this is...
Is that for the Democrats?
It's for the Democrats, yes. So do you know if there was an increase or what happened with Republicans?
We had about 38 at mine, and you know, last year, I think, or 2 years ago, I think we had about 80. And at our heyday, we used to have 150 to 200.
Interesting.
So we're down quite a bit. And... And I'm ending up as a state and county delegate.
Yeah.
And all of our races were uncontested. They were all by acclamation.
How interesting. I mean,
we had 4 slots.
Took away your desire to attend, I guess.
Well, for various reasons, folks weren't showing up. But for the 4 open slots for county delegates, these were not the ones that came with being a precinct chair or vice chair. We had 2 people volunteer to do it. Then after a long pause, I said, well, I'm willing to do it if nobody else does. Because clearly I've done it over, you know, decades. Yeah. And nobody else volunteered. And then the 4th one almost had to be begged, strongly encouraged to apply. And so it was just kind of sad because in past years, they've been highly contested. And now it was like, and the county race is where all the action is this year in Utah County.
Yeah.
I mean, we've got a lot of races there in the state. We got 1 race.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's good to see. I think the last time that Democrats saw this big of a turnout for caucus night was to support Bernie Sanders. And I do think sometimes people on just sort of in the general political world forget that Utah Democrats tend to be quite progressive, tend to fall pretty far left on.
Mm-hmm. This is one of my problems with the party.
Well, exactly. Mine too.
I would say the delegates do. Our representatives in the state legislature, I think, are very fair-minded moderates, largely. I think they are.
Oh, I would agree there.
Yeah, but in terms of the delegate body, we tend to be pretty far left. And it's
pretty rambunctious group.
Yeah, it's rambunctious. And I think what's interesting about that is we do have this competitive race in CD1. And I'm curious if we'll start to see some of the maybe fissures that we see in the Republican body here in the state when the delegates kind of go one direction, but then when it goes to primary and voters get to vote, that it maybe moves more towards the center.
And that'll be the interesting thing. Because sometimes in the Republican Party, delegates have been more conservative than the primary voter.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's been the opposite.
Yeah.
Sometimes the primary voters are more conservative than the delegates.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you one thing. If you want to improve turnout, make sure elections are competitive. That's what gets people to show up is having competitive elections.
Well, I phrased it.
Your vote matters.
Over the years, I phrased it a little bit different. You know, years ago in Highland City, it was like nobody was really showing up to vote. And I said, people are happy. I said, if you want higher voter turnout, piss people off.
Oh, yeah, that's fair.
Run the city poorly and everybody will show up to vote.
There's some of that happening in Utah County these days.
Yeah, that's interesting. Well, this is an interesting one. I didn't realize that the backers of the initiative to repeal Utah's ban on partisan gerrymandering, they have enough votes to qualify for the ballot. I knew that, but the margin continues to dwindle. And I guess it's in one of the Senate districts in Salt Lake County. This is Senator Reby's district.
To remind our voters.
To pull their names off.
To get it on the ballot, you had to get enough signatures in 26 of the 28 Senate districts.
Yeah.
And if you fall short in even one of those 26, you don't make it
on
the ballot.
Yeah.
And so what
you're describing is— So the opposition can target one Senate district.
And really try and steer to get the votes off in those 1 or 2. And we've got one that's within about 100 votes right now, last we checked.
And if I'm not mistaken, there are a couple more that are also dropping, not as precipitously as Senate District 15
has.
You can't
add signatures right now.
No.
This is a period where they file the signatures and the only path is to take them off.
To take them off. Yep.
Well, and a way to think of this is you live by the sword, die by the sword. They made it difficult to get on the ballot, but they also made it so there was a way to pull yourself from the ballot, and they're living by that right now.
And right on the edge.
Yeah.
And they've
something
got
to keep an eye on.
What do we have? Maybe 3 to 4 more weeks period where people can push to get signatures taken off?
Yeah. So it's a rolling 45-day deadline from the date that you signed it. So if you are one of the last people, if you signed in the last week, then you have 45 days from that deadline, which was Valentine's Day.
And they
Day
know the date that you signed. So they can watch that and they can target those
voters
in particular.
Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm.
Well, so this ICE detention center is getting a lot of news. Let's unpack it a little bit.
And I would just say I'd love to see the Prop 4 go on the ballot.
Okay. So this is a detention center in Western Salt Lake County, Western Salt Lake City. The governor was open that nobody locally was informed in advance that ICE was purchasing this warehouse. He thought that was a little frustrating. I know what that's like. I remember working in the governor's office when the feds would do something like declare a part of the state larger than Rhode Island a national monument without telling us.
Anyone, yeah.
I think it's a problem.
Hypothetically, or did that really take place? No, I'm just teasing.
Yeah, yeah.
Thanks, Bill Clinton.
Yeah. So, you know, I feel like that's unfortunate.
But didn't we know that they were looking for space out here? Didn't we know they were looking for a warehouse?
Yes.
We may not have known it was that warehouse, but at least we were on notice that they were looking for something.
Yeah. Well, and I'm
trying
to
generally
think,
not going to say we're looking for that thing, because then other folks are likely going to jack up the price. And
what would members of the congressional delegation, the governor, done if they were notified in advance? That what I would have done is I would have said, let's talk about where the best place to locate this is, and actually try to get some, you know, some support for what we're trying to do, and not only get support for the location of it, but for what happens there. They talk about it as a holding facility. And how you do this matters. I'm okay, you know, taking people that are here illegally and have committed crimes, and we've got to have a holding facility for them. But let's do it in a humane way. And if the state's at the table, I think we could protect that interest.
Okay.
And we don't have a lot of trust in the federal government.
There's no, at this point, there should be no grace, I feel, offered to DHS, given the behavior that we have seen, given the reporting that's coming out of the Dilley Detention Facility in Texas, the cases of measles, the way that people are being mistreated, the miscarriages that are happening. And I literally mean like people who are pregnant, not getting the care that they need. The kinds of inhumane treatment that are happening are now going to be on Cox's watch. And I do feel like this was a moment for him to stand up and say, under no circumstances is this in alignment with our values as Utahns, and we will work diligently to ensure that you are not able to perpetrate the kinds of violence that you're perpetrating on foreigners, you know, seeking refuge in a foreign land, because that doesn't align with our Christian values. But instead, what he did is stand up and say, this is Joe Biden's fault. And I was on the floor. I mean, I have just
unpacked that a little bit. What did he mean when he said that?
He said, this is Joe Biden's fault for letting in hundreds of millions of immigrants when he had a chance to do something about the border. And I'm like, I'm sorry, Governor Cox, you're in charge here now. And this is not going to be on your watch. And this is your party. So if you've got this great relationship with the president, you can call him and ask him to save the Great Salt Lake. I kind of think you could have gotten some inside information on this.
John, represent the right on this. Give us some take.
Well, so a big part. Yes, it's true. Joe Biden's fault. What he did, the mayhem at the southern border, was a disaster.
And okay? Before that,
and even
Trump,
many folks understood that was a problem. And
I would just say, as a
later,
data but, person, but, it's very clear what you're saying.
Yes, like
it was off the charts.
Yes. But right now, to your point, Shireen, we're here and now, and we have different choices of how we're going to respond to this.
Yeah.
Okay. And we can respond in a humane manner to say, okay, one, these are heinous criminals that need to be arrested and detained, incarcerated, deported, versus others that are here that are not committing those heinous crimes.
Right.
But how do we deal with helping them either return to their country, find employment, clear whatever status, if they're refugees, whatever it might be?
Right.
There are other ways to go about recognizing that these are human beings that are not, you know, those that are preying on our communities. How do we deal with those?
Well, I was
and what this facility is used for will also depend on what kind of support they see. I've seen it. Immigration is one of those things that divides both the Republican and Democrat Party over the decades.
What about a simple thing like this? You know, Mr. President, as a statewide elected official, I'll support this facility if you'll meet to these standards.
Yeah, like don't put children in there.
Just articulate it. And then you can feel as a, you know, the voting public that we're upholding our values as we do this. And I think he could have gotten that. I mean, you know, I don't think that the president's going to say, oh, let's go be inhumane there. I think we could try to hold him to standards.
We could try to hold him to standards. I'll just say I was very proud to stand out there last Wednesday night with hundreds of other Utahns holding signs and praying and calling for singing joyfully, you know, pushing back against what this is going to stand for, which is basically a Topaz 2.0. I mean, that's what we all see it as, just another way of detaining and turning people that do not deserve this kind of treatment. Mm-hmm. And as we're on that street, what's coming up and down that street? FedEx trucks. This is a warehouse facility. They are going to warehouse humans. It's not okay.
Yeah. You guys want to talk about gambling apps? Got about
what are the odds that you bring that one up?
What are the odds?
Well, on this one, Governor Cox.
It's March Madness, after all.
He knows his social media work. Yeah, yeah. And I actually applaud him protecting our children.
So this is an effort to basically stop an app that they're saying is not a gambling app, but certainly, I guess Governor Cox here said it's a betting app because it quacks like a duck. It's a duck, right? Mm-hmm. So efforts to stop gambling in our state.
There's that question of when is it a game of chance versus when is it a game of skill? And we see that with fantasy leagues and March Madness wagers. So.
Yeah. I mean, the only way I will go is just we have to protect our kids, and it's beyond the parents. We need government to get involved here, from what I've seen.
And this gets to be highly addictive.
Yeah. Okay. Let's wrap up. Thanks so much, Shireen John. Program's produced by Anthony Scoma. Thanks for listening, everyone.